I want today, the 17th of September, to speak to all soldiers in the group of armies under my command. What a change has come over the scene since I last spoke to you on the 21st of August. Then we were moving up towards the Seine, having inflicted a decisive defeat on the German armies in Normandy. Today, the Seine is far behind us. The Allies have removed the enemy from practically the whole of France and Belgium, except in a few places, and we stand at the door of Germany. We have advanced a great way in a short time, and we have accomplished much. The enemy has suffered immense losses in men and material. It is becoming problematical how much longer he can continue the struggle. Such a historic march of events can seldom have taken place in history in such a short space of time. You have every reason to be very proud of what you have done. Let us say to each other, this was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes.
Hello, BBC. This is Ian Wilson speaking from Supreme Headquarters. The Americans are over the Rhine. Supreme Headquarters announced a few minutes ago that General Hodges' 1st United States Army has crossed the Rhine. Elements reached the Rhine and crossed to establish a bridgehead on the east bank, somewhere south of Cologne.
Hello, BBC. This is Chester Wilmot speaking from Field Marshal Montgomery's headquarters. The German bridgehead west of the Rhine, opposite Basel, has been wiped out. Yesterday afternoon, three columns of Canadian, British and American troops broke through the last German defences 5 miles southwest of Basel and reached the western end of the two bridges which the Germans had blown yesterday morning. The end was sudden and swift. On Friday evening, the Germans were still resisting strongly, holding a line across the neck of the bend on which Basel stands. But during the night, they evidently withdrew the bulk of their forces, and when Montgomery's troops attacked yesterday morning, they found little more than rearguard parties covering roadblocks. During the day, the Germans were driven back more than 5 miles, and in the evening, British infantry of the 1st Canadian Army linked up with 9th Army troops opposite Basel. This means that the Allied armies now control the west bank of the Rhine from Arnhem to Endenach, 4 miles north of Koblenz. Though there may still be a few German stragglers at odd points along the west bank, and one pocket in an old fort upstream from Basel had not been fully cleaned up last night. The 21st Army Group began its drive to the Rhine 33 days ago. In that time, it's captured more than 50,000 prisoners. Of these, 29,000 have been taken by the 9th Army and 21,000 by the British and Canadians. In that time, Montgomery's forces have driven the Germans back between 12 and 25 miles along a 60-mile front.
The battle order, the schedule of operations for this great airborne landing in Germany, took up a score of pages of typewritten foolscap, with appendices and charts and timetables and maps. By reading it, you could see how immensely complicated is such an operation. In fact, how great a triumph today has been for Allied planning and execution. The Germans had said that they were ready for airborne landings. They were not, I think, expecting anything quite as powerful and concentrated as this, the biggest airborne force ever carried in one attack. It was British and American, flying parallel within easy sight of each other, the Halifaxes and the Stirlings towing their horses and Hamilcars, the Dakotas each drawing their two wacko gliders. Around us all, giving encouraging flashes in the sun, dashed the little fighters, British and American too. Some from bases in England, some from the forward airfields on the northwestern front. Slowly, I thought contemptuously, the great air fleet moved into Germany. It was so long that the head of the procession was now passing us on its way out. A Stirling shot by with flames coming from its belly. Four white parachutes fled from it and opened and swayed off down to the river bank. The Stirling crashed in a great gout of flame. You thought of the human element then. I looked back to see it through one of our rear windows and caught the eye of Bob Wade, my engineer, crouched over his apparatus. I knew that he'd seen it too. Ahead of us, German flak was staining the sky with its blue-black ink spots. Another tug went down, flaming. No one got out. The tail broke off a glider behind us and went spinning away. The glider paused a second as though surprised, and then reared up and fell, somersaulting. There are no parachutes in gliders. We were almost on the dropping zone now, the patchwork of fields that I'd seen marked out on large-scale photographs, lying below us in the glare of the sun and a dazzling mist. We called up Hamilcar 277 for the last time. You are over your dropping zone now. The Halifax skipped a little as the glider let go. We turned sharply and a great bunch of flak turned with us just off the starboard wing. 277 wheeled away beautifully, and then I lost sight of her as she joined the hundreds of others, banking silently down like a flight of tired moths seeking their rest on the ground. And as we turned, I saw simultaneously the smoke of five aircraft blazing like torches in the fields and the woods just below. Some German guns fired, and the Typhoons, who were patrolling on the lookout for just such a thing, swooped and were gone down in a flash to strafe the gunners. Our fighter protection had been first class, but you can't subdue everyone, and there were some of our force who paid the price for hauling their gliders to the right spot at the right time. We, who were lucky, edged out of it and belted back for the Rhine, where Allied guns were setting up grey smoke clouds and Allied craft were crossing the broad river. There were tanks closing up in the winding roads of the West Bank and great convoys of lorries. Below us, the army was on the move into Germany. And back in the flak stains and the mist, its spearhead was now on the ground and fighting by the empty hulks of the gliders among the black pillars of smoke. The funeral pyres of some of those whose pride it had been to lead the spearhead in.
Our period of waiting is over. This is the time. In the Buffalo, that strange all-purpose vehicle which is taking us over the Rhine, I'm crouching with the commanding officer of the assault battalion. And in his Bren gun carrier fills the Buffalo, and on the Bren gun carrier pile his men, tin-hatted, and we're watching, gazing towards that far bank of the Rhine. It's a fantastic sight. We've broken out first through the Bund, the wall that retains the floodwaters of the Rhine, and we're out in the open spaces. Overhead goes an absolute crisscross pattern of our tracers, firing in as fast as they can into the German bank, the thunder of our guns echoing and crashing in our ears. As we waited, we were deafened by the noise and blinded by their flashes. But now we seem alone, out here in the open space, right on the water's edge, waiting for the final signal. The Buffalo, the driver in charge, man of the Royal Tank Regiment, is receiving the signal. The captain's waving to him. And this is where we move. Buffalo driver gives an extra rev as he feels for the edge of the water. We're guided up right to the very edge by a long little line of small green lights that have been laid to take us to the jumping off ground. A last look back at the shore we're leaving. The searchlights are playing. Sing one, wave us up, and in it a lone star. And the moonlight filling the sky. But here ahead of us, there's no effect of moonlight at all. We've reached the water's edge, and we see the Rhine. Not running, as we thought it would, bright under the moon, but running red. Because right on the opposite side of the village, every single house and haystack you can see is burning, beaten down by the fury of our barrage. Slowly, carefully, we come down to the water's edge.
Hello, BBC. This is Stuart McPherson reporting from Germany. One has only to spend a few minutes among our advancing troops on the far side of the Rhine to feel the almost frenzied spirit of offense that is running through every single formation. This morning I went across one of the Rhine bridges, and all along the route I was staggered by the hustle and dash of every single formation, right down from the military police to to squadron commanders who were racing tanks across the river and far beyond on the other side. Up to the time of the Rhine push, it had always been a good idea to slow down when approaching a bridge, for that was the direction that was glaring at you in bold red letters off a snow-white signboard. But no more. Things have changed. I had hardly put the nose of the car down towards the start of the bridge when an English policeman bellowed, "Come on, mate, flat out across that bridge." Halfway across the river, another red cap shouted even louder, "Come on, mate, you're holding traffic up. Show a pace, show a pace." By the time we reached the far side of the river, we seemed to be flying. And what was so strange, particularly for British policemen, was that the MP on the far side just smiled and waved us on up onto the far bank. Vehicles reaching the east side of the river were quickly whisked away to their various destinations. It was almost like a big day at Brooklands.
This afternoon, the Prime Minister, Mr. Winston Churchill, crossed the Rhine in a landing craft on the American 9th Army beachhead sector and spent a quarter of an hour walking around and inspecting the signs of yesterday's battle on the eastern bank. With Mr. Churchill were Sir Alan Brooke, Chief of the Imperial General Staff, Field Marshal Montgomery, and General Simpson, Commander of the American 9th Army. During his quarter hour in the bridgehead, the Prime Minister climbed one of the great earthen dikes which were fought for by the infantry and discussed the landings with the American General, Simpson. Later, the Prime Minister made a short cruise along the Rhine in the landing craft, his first cruise on this great river since he sailed it in a motor torpedo boat just after the last war. Mr. Churchill then said he would like to see Wesel, and the party drove north. Mr. Churchill, leading the party, climbed onto the first span of the great Wesel Bridge, which was the retreating Germans destroyed, and he inspected the ruins of the town through his binoculars. While the Prime Minister was on the bridge, our guns were in action and landing craft were crossing, and the sound of machine gun and rifle fire could be heard clearly from the town. The Prime Minister spent 3 hours in the 9th Army sector.
This chase after the Germans flying in confusion from the banks of the Rhine has been one of the strangest experiences of the war. Our tanks have long ago left the torn and shattered landscape around Wesel and Xanten, where we first forced the crossing. They are now out in undamaged country, racing through villages which have never seen war, villages from which the inhabitants haven't been forced to fly to the woods, as they were in the little places we captured nearer the bank. And for the first time, I think we are getting the real feeling of conquest. When you can drive, as I have today, for 30 miles along undamaged roads with not a sign of the enemy and no sound of gunfire, and not the slightest trace of snipers or guerrilla fighting or any last-minute defense, then the end can't be far off. Occasionally, little groups have tried to hold us up. The airborne boys told us of one such group, composed of Hitler youth, of about 15, who formed a bazooka team at a roadblock. But they were quickly swept aside, and our tanks and guns are rolling ahead through this level, well-tilled country, past the big red brick farmhouses, every one with this little white sheet hanging from the windows, and on through the woodlands, pressing eastward mile after mile without pause. And everyone is moving faster because out here we can see the end to it all now. And it's the strangest possible sensation to be driving almost at will, utterly unmolested, through the heart of your enemy's country. It just doesn't seem possible, and yet, somehow, here we are.
I was sitting in the kitchen of a small country town hotel. We had come into the German kitchen not to fraternize, that strictly forbidden practice, but because we had seen a large radio set there and wanted to hear the BBC news at 9 o'clock. It took us some time to find London on the dial, and the announcer had already begun the bulletin when we brought his voice loud and clear into the room. The hotel family was already there when we came in. The old white-haired man who watched us fearfully, I think the Germans had told him terrible stories of what we would do, his two not unattractive daughters, by no means frightened,
and his gray-haired wife, who sat knitting at the table. A woman friend was visiting them, one of the smarter women of the little town, with her hair caught up in a bright turban and wearing what looked to me very like fully fashioned silk stockings. They, at least the women, were ready and anxious to talk, but we made it pretty clear that we had come in only to hear the wireless. As we sat listening to the news about this battle area, I watched the reaction of this German family, which had been engulfed in the fighting a very short time before, and could hear it going on now if we turned off the set. They were listening quite intently, understanding no English, but catching the German place names as Freddie Griswold mentioned them. And as I watched them, a thought struck me. This was a recital from London of our success, of the growing and spreading defeat of their country. And yet there was not one sound or sign of regret on their faces. No shock, no despair, no alarm. They just picked up what was said, checked it on the map, and noted it, just as if they were a bunch of neutrals hearing all about somebody else. And indeed, I believe that that's what many of these frontline German people are. Neutrals in their own country.
Yes, the moment of release was, without any doubt, the greatest of my life, and in the lives of all my fellow prisoners of war of our flag 12B. We'd been moved from the camp in which we'd spent 18 weary months, and had gone through somewhat anxious period, expecting a further move from day to day. But the move never came, and every day brought the American troops nearer to us in their spectacular advance through Germany. We were standing at the edge of a slag heap in the little railway town of Lollar, a few miles north of Gießen, when the great moment came. It was epitomized by a great cry of the American tanks, a concerted shout which went up in English, French, Russian, Polish, Dutch, Italian, German, in fact, in almost every conceivable language, from the packed group of people from every corner of Europe and the British Empire to whom the arrival of the Americans meant deliverance. To us of Oflag 12B, the senior British officer's camp in Germany, which included 11 brigadiers, it meant the end of a long, weary term of imprisonment dating back to Dunkirk days for some. To the French, Belgians, Dutch, Russians, Poles, and others, it meant emancipation from slavery. Rumors had been flying around for days about where the American troops were. German trucks returning from the front were continually claiming to have missed capture by minutes. But early on Wednesday afternoon, it became plain that the Americans were very close. Our temporary camp was a group of huts out in an open field with a slag heap and an arms factory, which had long since ceased active production, behind us. About 3 o'clock in the afternoon, things began to warm up. Shells began to fall ahead of us in the field, and machine gun fire began to get more and more intense. Soon we could see figures appearing on the horizon. It was decided to evacuate the camp to the German air raid shelters, which were dug deep under the slag heap. Our German guards no sooner entered the shelters than they unbuckled their arms and threw them in heaps in corners of the shelter. They'd been a little bit embarrassed about their arms for some time. They thought they wouldn't get a very good reception from the Americans if they were armed. I dumped my belongings in the shelter and went outside. The noise of the battle increased. And then suddenly, out of a wood, came the American tanks and tracked troop carriers. Everyone became delirious with excitement. "Come on and see the American tanks," I shouted to some Russian girls who'd been working in the station restaurant. "American tanks? Невозможно!" they cried. "Pas possible!" cried the French. But it was possible. It was true. One of the troop carriers stopped. Two men jumped out and came down to the far bank of the Lahn River, which separated us from them. I ran down the steep bank on my side. By the greatest piece of luck, there was an old barge tied up there. "How's things over there with you?" the Americans asked. "Fine," I said. "You want to come across?" "Yeah, can you get that boat over?" "You bet your life I can." And with three others, including the only American POW in the camp, I poled the rickety old craft across. "How are your guards?" the Americans asked when we were about in midstream. "Like lambs," I said. "You needn't worry about them." "Oh, we're not worrying," said one of the Americans, fingering his gun. We nearly upset the boat on the return trip, but we got our deliverers safely and dryly across. They forced their way through a cheering crowd of POWs and foreign workers. Relief lit up the faces of even the Germans. No more bombs, no more alarms for them. The worst of the war was finished as far as they were concerned.
I think it was one of the most moving experiences of my life, going into the Siegenhain prison camp after its liberation by General Patton's troops. There were 1,200 British troops there, men from all parts of the Commonwealth, and my colleague Bill Costello and I were the first Englishmen they'd seen, the first free Englishmen, as one of them said, in 5 years. Well, I can't begin to describe what it felt like meeting those men. It was one of those occasions when all you could do was to wring hands by the score, to hug and be hugged, to slap each other on the back, to do anything rather than to attempt to talk. We were all too full for words. Then when we got over the first gulp of emotion, the things they wanted to know, the torrent of information which poured out from both sides, the fuss they wanted to make of us when we wanted to make the fuss of them, I went into one of the hospital wards where men were lying weak with exhaustion and dysentery. Yet not a complaint did I hear, nothing but thankfulness for deliverance. And then that eager stream of inquiries from men who raised themselves weakly on their elbows, called out to me to come over and shake hands with them, then fired questions at me about almost every town in Britain. There were East Enders who wanted to know what London looked like after the bombing. There was a Stockport lad whose folk lived not far away from my own home. Then there was a Heckmond White boy and a lad from Salford in the bunk above him. The arrival of another Yorkshireman set them bantering each other about the possibilities of being home for Whit Monday in time to see either Lancashire or Yorkshire wallop each other at Old Trafford or Headingley. And they were all busy writing home, the first letters in which they could really express themselves freely for the first time in 5 years. And they were also enjoying the luxury of real and unlimited cigarettes. Words fail me to describe the spirit of that camp and those men, with its magnificent self-imposed discipline, those three officers and those giants among NCOs, men of confidence, they call them, who are keeping the place going until transport facilities are available to send everybody home.
Here, over an acre of ground, lay dead and dying people. You could not see which was which, except perhaps by a convulsive movement or the last quiver of a sigh from a living skeleton too weak to move. The living lay with their heads against the corpses, and around them moved the awful ghostly procession of emaciated, aimless people, with nothing to do and no hope of life, unable to move out of your way, unable to look at the terrible sights around them. There was no privacy, nor did men or women ask it any longer. Women stood and squatted stark naked in the dust, trying to wash themselves and to catch the lice on their bodies. Babies had been born here, tiny, wizened things that could not live. A mother, driven mad, screamed at a British sentry to give her milk for her child, and thrust the tiny mite into his arms and ran off, crying terribly. He opened the bundle and found the baby had been dead for days. This day at Belsen was the most horrible of my life.